summer's almost gone. Summer's gone.
Greetings, everybody. This is Tabitha. Welcome to another edition of White Wellness. That right there was The Doors with Summer's Almost Gone back in 1968. And today is Wednesday, September 22nd, 2021, broadcasting out of New York for White Wellness Radio. So today's topic is autumnal abundance. And that's also the title of the show. Got a great picture of some pumpkins in a melange of different hues. So today's show is going to be all about fall. Happy equinox to everyone listening to the broadcast. Today is the autumnal or the fall equinox or equinox, the first day of fall. And the Farmer's Almanac is still one of those kind of reliable sources to read about the equinox. So this date marks the fall of the Northern Hemisphere and spring in the Southern Hemisphere. And here's a groovy quote about the autumn. "Autumn has caught us in our summer wear," British poet Philip Larkin, 1922-1986. That's why I played that song by The Doors, "Summer is Almost Gone," because summer is officially gone, and it's nice to embrace the new season. I'm sure many of you listening are excited about the wonderful fall produce, maybe apple picking, pumpkin picking, taking hikes, sitting outside for bonfires, all the delicious recipes, all the amazing holidays, despite all the crud that's still going on in the world. I was almost going to play The Pusher by Steppenwolf off of the Easy Rider soundtrack, also from the same year, 1968, because that's what's happening. Big Z is pushing their you know, Talmudic, allopathic, Talmudopathic agenda on everybody as the pusher man, essentially. But I figured it would be more uplifting to use a kind of a positive song like Summer's Almost Gone by The Doors. So what is an equinox? The word equinox comes from the Latin equis, meaning equal, and nox, night. On the equinox, day and night are roughly equal in length. So of course, this would happen in the fall as well as in the spring. Those are when the equinoxes are, and then we have the solstices in winter, like Yule, and then one in the summer. So pretty cool, a lot of energy happening right now. We just had a new moon in Pisces on Monday, and we just moved into the sign of Libra just a couple of days ago as well, the sign of the scales, the only Western zodiac sign that is not an animal or a human. And this was just a harvest moon that we had, by the way. Every moon has like a name, all the 13 moons of the year. And there's also 13 moons in a woman's menstrual cycle when it's working with the moon. Just shows how aligned we are with nature. One of the reasons that Zog is misogynistic or hates women is because Zog hates nature. And women naturally being the more intuitive of the sexes, men being more logical and analytical, they blend together. And that's why Big Z hates anything to do with biophobia, because it's that intuition. That's going to be something we're talking about a little bit throughout this show, especially later when we talk about spleen health, because oftentimes in nutrition, it's very logical and very analytical, and that could be totally helpful, but there's not really that intuitive or how a certain foodstuff or herb would work for you compared to somebody else. So this harvest moon, back to the equinox, has to do with farming. Around the fall equinox, a full moon rises around sunset for several days in a row, which traditionally provided farmers with just enough extra light for them to finish their harvest before the killing frost of fall finally set in. Normally, the moon rises about a half hour later each night. But around the time of the equinox, the angle of the moon's orbit and the tilt of the Earth line up just right and cause the moon to rise only about 20 to 30 minutes later each night for several nights in a row. Pretty cool. And there's oftentimes different names for different moons based on the culture or the race, but this one's pretty much typically known as the harvest moon. And of course, who loves to see the fall foliage around this time of year, seeing all the wonderful crisp leaves and all the great autumnal colors. And this is a time of year where we're going into, of course, the cold time of year, which would be the time of the crone, the elder, the wise elder woman, which of course in this Zog culture is oftentimes relegated to the lowest person on the totem pole, especially probably if a lesbian. So let's talk a little bit about this Norse mythological crone, because we're moving into that time of year, even though right now we're in the fall season. And not to jump the gun on all the amazing things we have going on right now, we have Samhain, Halloween, we have Thanksgiving, we have Yule or Christmas, we have all the full moons before that. So there's a lot of energy going on this time of year. And we should still be enjoying these things, even despite what is going on in the world, of course, being kept aware. But this Oyid narrative is definitely not going anywhere. They could keep this up for 5 years, according to some accounts. So that would mean that that's 60 months, and we're only 18 of those in. So this could be going on for like 42 more months, as mind-seeing as that sounds. The lies are going to get deeper and deeper. The latest Zog lie is that the mad Chi-Com scientist was trying to deliberately put the man-made virus into the bat so the bat would distribute the virus. So that's the new angle that they're working on. It's kosher theater through and through, up and down. Why not see it for what it is and still enjoy the things that we have in this world, like nature, the seasons, seasonal food, conversation with other humans, things like that. So here is a little bit about this this Norse figure known as Hyndla. And Hyndla, spelled H-Y-N-D-L-A, is a vulva. interesting that that's the word, because vulva is the vagina, meaning the outside area of the vagina. So what is a vulva? A vulva is a shamanic seeress, or a wise woman in Norse paganism. According to the short Eddic poem Volupsa Hin Skama, all vulvas or valas come from Viulf. Several vulvas are mentioned in the poetic Edda. In Valuspa, Odin, the chief of the gods, calls on a certain vulva in his search for knowledge. She speaks to him unwillingly, being compelled to do so by his magic power. The vulva first tells him of the past and of the creation of the world, and then she discloses some of Odin's own secrets and the details of his search for knowledge. Finally, she turns the real prophecy and discloses the final destruction of the gods. In the Baldur's Draumar, Odin raises vulva from the grave by magic and mighty charms to answer questions about Baldur's fate. Another vulva, named Hyndla, is awakened by the goddess Freya to trace the ancestry of her protege Ottar. The story is told in the Eddic poem Hyungildu. In the poem Grogaldor, in Svipdagsmál, the vulva Groa is raised by the dead from her son Svipdagr. She helps him by casting 9 spells for him. So that's who this character is. And I'm realizing it's kind of the same thing they've done with the word cunt, where the word cunt meant kundalini or goddess, or having to do with women, just like the word cute has to do with the word women, fecundant, like something that's fertile and green and lush. They've done the same thing with vulva. This elderly wise woman has now been thought of as just like a vagina, like a thing, right? And also not revered in the current Zog culture. The current Zog culture doesn't revere elders in general. We have that kind of fuck you old man style thing going on in this country, where like once you're over a certain age, you're just yesterday's newsprint, which is kind of fucked up. It was especially evident with the beginning of Wayid AI when they were offing all those seniors. So that's a little bit about this goddess Hyndla. Let's just check the chat for just a moment, see what's going on there. Okay, we've got some people listening. So a little bit more about this goddess called the Hermit, Hyndla. That was just a little bit about her backstory and a bit about the word vulva. So who is Hyndla? Deep in the northern mountains of Junoheim lies the cave of the giantess goddess Hyndla, the hag or the wise woman of the northern mountains, and the goddess of genealogy and bloodlines. This is like a racial goddess, an elder racial goddess. Why do we have a goddess of genealogy? Who knows, but we do. And just the fact that there is a goddess of genealogy in the Norse mythology shows that this was an important part of our belief system, to have a specific genealogy where we would not mix our blood. Of course, not out of hate or vitriol for other races, out of protection and love for our own. So Hyndla can see into every genetic line and knows everything there is to know about everyone's kin and clan. She is the mistress of bloodlines. Ancestry is her speciality, and it is rumored that she spends her astral travel time walking up and down the bloodlines of many races. The gods consult her when they want to know something about how someone is related or to someone else, or for advice on their various human breeding experiments. Non-god consults her about discovering unknown ancestors, tracing genetic disorders, dealing with blood curses, asking about future children, or anything else that requires an ability to see into bloodlines far away. Hyndla's gifts include helping those who are adopted get some idea of their parentage, and to help anyone who is interested in finding out about their ancestry. She knows a great deal about genetic dis-ease. Well, that is a hollow hoax. I mean, you can have dis-ease that manifests in generation after generation, but it's not genetic, like, oh, this is the curse of my family, it's genetic. It's malnutrition multi-generationally, it's toxicity, trauma, etc. The fact that we would be born less than perfect just for the fuck of it is a Zog belief, and it's part of that sinner belief, as opposed to, no, we were born perfect, there's some shit that happened along the way that fucked us up. So back up to where I was talking about genetic dis-ease. And while she's not a healer, so not a healing goddess, she can help with getting genetic illnesses diagnosed, okay, maybe help with nutritional repairing or something like that. See how even this Zog allopathic dialectic is feeding into this article about Norse mythology and the crone energy? It's everywhere. And one could perhaps pray to her to help find conventional treatment. Okay. She knows whether any given trait will be passed down through the blood to any given child, so people who want to have children and are worried about passing along diseases might speak to her. She can tell you whether your bloodline is cursed as well. She is especially good for consultations about humans with problems from non-human blood. Interesting. It is said that at one time she lived in Svartafheim and guarded the mead of poetry for Invaldi, the goddess of Durgar, but two Durgar brothers stole the mead and later lost it to Suttung, and Hyndla retired to a cave in the northern mountains. She spends most of her time sleeping, or what looks like sleeping to some folk. Actually, she is faring forth, sending her mind out where her body cannot go. I guess that's the astral travel. Her cave is guarded by a band of loyal Ettins who will not see her disturbed when she is unconscious, so seeing her is only possible during the short periods when she wakes up to eat and walk about a little. Hyndla is small for a giantess, not more than a human side, and wizened and old with long silver-gray hair that drapes on the ground around her. See, she doesn't cut her hair. People have a history or of doing that for a long time. She is pale from almost never leaving her cave and walks with a stick. Sounds like the modern internet personality, right? Her apparent frailty makes her guards all the more protective of her. Hyndla is generally friendly, but can sometimes be cantankerous if she has just awoken. Flirting with her will usually soften her, but be prepared to go through what it is if she decides to take you up upon it. For she is old and wrinkled, she is also lusty. Her name means hound, and indeed she does have a small pack of silver-colored greyhounds as pets, usually lollying about her and keeping her warm. She can shapeshift into a hound herself or a dog-headed woman, and it is in this form that she appears on a famous carved Icelandic stone. She has a stable of pet dogs and wolves. Some of the latter are large enough to ride as steeds. In the lay of Hyndjulgod, Freya comes in riding on a boar and suggests that Hyndla accompany her for a ride with one of her wolves whilst they discuss genealogy. This is another example of how powerful this little giantess in her own speciality. For the Vanadis to consult her, she must be skilled indeed. So a little bit there about some Norse mythology that I think kind of is appropriate for the time that we're living in, because we're kind of moving into the fall season, which is the season of the crone. The moon kind of follows that same thing. We have the moon that is waxing, meaning it's becoming full. Then we have the full moon, and then we have the waning moon, when the moon is, waxing, when it becomes the crone. And that's kind of like considered the three phases of a woman's life, from maiden, mother, and crone. And interestingly enough, the menstrual cycle is broken into four seasons, summer, spring, fall, and winter. So a lot of this you can see is very cyclic, very natural. And I think breaking some of these JWO, programming, whatever tattoos that everyone had when they were born into the Zog world, requires thinking in more of an intuitive way, because we're nearly not trained to think that way. We're trained to think in more of an analytical and logical way, which is Jim Dandy and definitely has its place. But oftentimes we can miss the more subtle things when we don't think in an intuitive way, or when we just completely rely too much on technology and stuff like that. And more and more and more is the world becoming like that, where they're only going to be taking the word of what a machine says, what a diagnostic says, right? This is better than what you intuit, what you know, right? What you crave. So thinking in this more softer way, this more yin way, is really about embracing your own self-trust, something that is going extinct at a rapid rate due to things like Oyed AI, right? Among other things. I mean, there's so many pogroms out there, but that's like the one we're really dealing with right now, with all the crud that's going on in the world. That's the top pogrom, but that's the one that is really the biggest one, just to show how much you don't trust yourself if you believe and fall for any of that shit. So today's broadcast, I'm happy to announce that most of the material that I'll be utilizing for the broadcast is actually from books, not from internet articles. Well, a few are, but mostly from books. I love getting into books, especially this time of year. So I've got a lot of interesting things I found in books for this broadcast, not just about food, but about everything. Food, race, the equinox, a little bit about nutrition and the organs, a bit of everything on this seasonal broadcast today. So I wanted to talk a little bit about, I should have mentioned this prior when I was talking about the equinox, but we'll just rewind a slight bit, a little bit about a cleansing spell that one can do to bring in the equinox, also known as Mabon to pagans, so whatever you want to call yourself, heathen, racialist, Vedicist. It doesn't really matter, I guess, overall. It's just that it's not Extian, right? It's not Pislamic. It's not New Age. It's not Judaism. So, yeah. So here is a cleansing spell you can do to welcome in the autumn equinox of Mabon. Whereas Ostara, Easter, etc., right? Or whatever, what became Easter, is about light, rebirth, fertility, fecundity, all that greenery, that freshness, you know, eggs, fresh herbs. Mabon at the autumn equinox is about harvesting, death, and the darker aspects of life. So that's why I read that thing about Hyndla, who is a crone goddess, essentially, right? It's about going into the dark right now. So this is the darker aspects of life when Ostara deals with the lighter aspects of life. Mabon is often thought of as the witch's Thanksgiving. So happy witch Thanksgiving to everybody listening, as it is the second harvest festival. As we're preparing to turn inward for the winter months, it's a wonderful time to spruce up the energy of your home. So this is a good time to maybe do some cleaning, maybe arrange the furniture a little bit differently, sometimes called feng shui, something like that to really just cleanse the energy and maybe put some groovy decorations up for the holiday. I have already a couple of things up. I have a little thing of pumpkin lights. I have a couple of pumpkins just out around the house. I'll be going apple picking in a couple of weeks. Hopefully picking one of the oldest apples that's still being produced. There's a groovy apple that it was introduced in France in the 1600s called Blanc de Hiver. I think it means white winter, like Blanc is white and Hiver, like D-Iver, apostrophe Iver. I think that means winter. It's one of the best apples I've ever had. It has a real old school look where it's got a big plump top and kind of like a tapered bottom, like a muffin. And it's green and crisp and has such a natural bouquet in the way it smells and tastes. But these are the things to celebrate this time of year. And back to the Mabon cleansing spell. This cleansing spell features easy to source essential oils to clear away clutter and negative energies. Great time of year to do this. Lemon for purification and energy attunement, lavender for peace and purification, and cedar for purification and dispelling negativity. Vinegar is an effective natural cleanser for removing dirt and grime, and that is definitely true. I always keep some distilled vinegar in the house, not necessarily for cooking, but for cleaning the sink, cleaning the counter, making stuff like this. That's really what I use it for. Other vinegars would be used for food, like apple cider vinegar, coconut vinegar. But then again, too much vinegar, not so good. A little bit can help with digestion. Too much can harm the spleen. So what do you need for this Mabon cleansing spray? You'll need a spray bottle, about 20 ounces in size, preferably glass, 8 ounces of water, preferably filtered, 3 drops lavender oil, 2 tablespoons baking soda, try to get the aluminum free, 8 ounces distilled white vinegar, 4 drops lemon oil, and 2 drops cedar oil. So what you do is you cleanse your altar and your tools, add the ingredients to the bottle one at a time whilst focusing on your intentions. Hold the bottle in your hand and charge for use in purifying and refreshing your home. Spray down the kitchen countertops, the windows, the walls, visualizing old, stagnant energies being washed away. Dry with a clean cloth. When the cleaning is complete, speak an incantation. In this kitchen, I banish all that is unwelcome. In this home, I purify the energy. In this space, I welcome peace and balance. So pretty groovy how just cleaning like the counters can become like a ritual or a spell, whatever you want to call it. It's great to have rituals. They've stripped us of our rituals and they want us to think of things like Black Friday or Juneteenth as a ritual or Cinco de Mayo or whatever else they have up their sleeve. Forget about all of that and get back to your own racial roots and rituals. So pretty cool right there. I think I'm actually going to make this. I have everything. I have the spray bottle. I have the water. I have all the essential oils, the vinegar. I think I'm actually going to make this. And just, it's going to be nice to have the counter smell really groovy too. Lavender, so you have that floral smell. Lemon, very purifying and like a smell of like new beginnings. And then the cedar is like that nice kind of like masculine woodsy smell. That'll really make the kitchen smell really nice. See, things like that can naturally be done to enhance the environment, boost one's mood, etc. Let's take a gander at the chat. Okay, Keen Rich is saying, greetings, happy equinox. Yeah, happy equinox and happy fall moon to everybody. XO is saying, just cleaned my floor. Could I use this? Well, there's always next time, right? Floors, counters, kitchen cabinets, maybe like the wall, if there's like a smudge on the wall or something, sinks. OG is saying, will this get rid of evil spirit smell of cat shit soaked into my daughter's floor? I mean, maybe. it's worth a shot, you know? It's definitely worth a shot. Those oils can kind of cover it up and the vinegar can kind of help. Cat poop, it doesn't smell very good. Not at all, actually. It smells pretty gross. All right, moving on. Just going to close these windows. So far I talked about the equinox, talked about Hyndla, who is this Norse goddess of bloodlines and genealogy. So now I want to talk a little bit about carrots. Carrots are one of the vegetables of this season. They are usually available in the stores year-round. They're very tasty, enjoyable raw as well as cooked. And there are two different schools of thought in regards to where they originated, but both of these places happen to be in the Middle East. Of course, the Middle East was originally white. We can still see the remnants of that when we see pictures of certain people like the Yazidi, who definitely are a white group, and they are spiritual Satanists too, as far as I know. So here's the first little tidbit about carrots. And like I said, definitely a great vegetable to have. And they're really coming into season now, even though they're typically available year round and very affordable, especially in temperate areas like where I am. A native of Afghanistan and a relative of celery, parsnips, the caraway seed, cilantro, or coriander, that's the root, cumin, and dill. The carrot is a most useful, versatile, nutritious, and popular vegetable. Revered not only as an accompaniment to other dishes, but as a base ingredient for soups, stocks, and stews. In the hotels in the town of Vichy, France, where the recipe for Vichyssoise, that cold potato and leek soup, carrots are eaten as daily as part of a cure for overloaded digestion, and many cultures have valued them as an aphrodisiac. Researchers have shown that 3 raw carrots eaten daily lower blood cholesterol, and that a single carrot per day cuts the risk of lung cancer in half. Carrots are rich sources of carotenoids, B vitamins, phosphorus, calcium, and iodine. And of course, carrots have vitamin A in the form of beta carotene, not retinol. Many people cannot convert that. I'm convinced that many of those people are possibly European, considering that a lot of our more ancient diets weren't heavy in the vegetation stuffs. So if you think you're getting vitamin A from winter squash or carrots or sweet potato, you're not. You're getting beta carotene and carbohydrates and other stuff that's pretty good, but you're not getting vitamin A that would be retinol from animal foods, which is in poultry liver, ruminant liver, eggs, and dairy food. Things like that would be the way to get vitamin A. Vitamin A is something that most people are deficient in. Typically, when youngsters have to get spectacles at a young age, that is because the mom was deficient whilst she was gestating and the child did not get enough vitamin A in utero. And of course, it's not just about eating vitamin A once you conceive, it's about building up that store. And that's true of anything, not just pregnancy. It's true of any type of state. Like, let's say, like, when you see an elderly person who happens to be a bit larger, like some people, when they get old, they get like really frail. The person who's typically a little larger, if they take a fall or that they take a spill or whatever, they end up doing better after that happens because they have a little bit of resilience. So you always want to be nourished. I mean, a lot of diseases or things that we see today that we think are like diseases is really just a state of dis-ease, not being in ease. That's because of not just trauma and toxins, of course, but because most people are essentially incredibly devitalized, multi-generationally so, and they don't even know because their parents didn't know and they're still following some version of the Zog diet. Thoughts as Seeds is saying adequate B12 is necessary to convert the carotene. Yes, that's important too, and that would be gotten from only animal foods. There is no B12 in vegetation. It's from the soil. Some vegetabilists have taken to consuming the soil, trying to get the B12, and there could have been all types of stuff in there that maybe wasn't the best move for them to do. But yeah, we need all the vitamins and minerals to work in concert together, like a song, essentially, to get the desired result. And that's why oftentimes taking these synthetics will deplete you of something else. So it's always good to take a whole food source of something. At least that's what I think, the approach that makes the most amount of sense to me. So that was a little bit about carrots right there. This article saying that they come from Afghanistan. And this little tidbit of information comes from a pretty interesting cookbook. It's older. I've had this since 2004, so going back some time now. It's one of the first Sally Fallon or Weston A. Price Foundation cookbooks, Nourishing Traditions, the cookbook that challenges politically correct nutrition and the diet dictocrats. This is a pretty groovy book. Lots of good recipes and lots of just like fun stories on the side. And here is a quote that's also in this book that I think pertains very accurately in regards to what we have going on today in the world with Oyed AI and just the entire romance that most people have with allopathy. And this quote comes from Dr. Henry Beeler, who is the author of Food is Your Best Medicine, as well as another book on sexual health. He was a doctor, an allopath, but like a really holistic doctor, really not an allopath. I think he was trained to become an allopath because he was an MD, but he didn't believe in germ theory, first of all. And he knew the importance of getting in regular whole foods. He knew the importance of getting in things like, proper animal foods, eating things like raw eggs and like lightly seared lamb and beef. His books are very interesting if anyone is into exploring that a little bit more. He was also a doctor to many of the golden film stars, like in the 40s and 50s, I think, in America. So here is a really groovy quote from him. Unhappily anxiety-ridden Americans, following the warning voices of televised drug commercials and newspaper ads, consider health something that can be purchased in a bottle at the drugstore. They forget or never knew that the health can only be found by obeying the clear-cut laws of nature. And yeah, we will find out soon for the people who think they can violate nature what happens when they do that. That's pertaining to the Oyed AI vaccination. And here's a bit more about carrots. This coming from a magazine that I got in the mail. It's called Culture. It's all about cheese, actually. I got a free article. It's a pretty groovy magazine. I love just reading about food and stuff like that. It's really a great way to connect yourself to your roots. I mean, think about it. What's more personal to your race or culture than what you eat? It's so personal, even amongst Europeans or Americans. Like, there are regional dishes to New York, you know, regional dishes to California, regional dishes all over this country. That's true of any place that our people are or any place that any people are in the world. So here is a little bit more about carrots. And I'm a big fan of carrots. I've eaten them throughout my whole life, even as I've sifted and grifted into different dietary ideologies or philosophies, if you will. Carrots have always been something that have been a mainstay for me since I was a youngster. So this article is called Have Carrots Will Travel. Sweet, crunchy, and malleable. This veg can go anywhere. Creative freedom is a huge carrot. Film and television director and producer Adam McKay may have been explaining when he used those words why independent film was a draw for him, but I read the sentence through a culinary lens. Creative freedom is indeed a huge carrot. It's true. The ubiquitous carrot, which is seemingly always in season in one variety or another, can be prepared with imagination in a myriad of ways. And in doing so, the carrots in your refrigerator at home can take you anywhere you might want to go. Raw, the most kind of, with most of the dirt brushed off if you're a kid in the backyard garden. Peeled, steamed, and tossed with spicy harissa and preserved lemon if you're in a restaurant in Morocco. Shredded into a cake and sitting in your grandmother's kitchen table. Sitting at your grandmother's kitchen table. Sliced and simmered in chicken broth with onions and thyme if you're with Alice Waters at Chez Panisse in Berkeley. Carrots have a long history. They originated in ancient Persia or Iran. So this source is saying Iran. The other one is saying Afghanistan. Of course, similar-ish area. Not exactly, you know, but still somewhere, I'm guessing, in that part of the world. Seeds have been found in Switzerland and Germany dating back to 3000 BC, when their leafy greens were used medicinally. And yeah, the greens typically, I think, are pretty high in oxalates and other stuff. People really shouldn't be eating those. Like, I've seen recipes for pesto. I think I made one many, many, many years ago. But those are medicine. Like, pretty much all plants, especially certain ones, are really, really strong. They're used medicinally, and that's what they're so great for. References to eating carrot roots like we do now appear in 1st century AD Roman texts. The Moors brought them to Spain circa 900, and the Dutch are widely credited with engineering an orange version of the previously purple root around 1600. I didn't know that they were originally purple, and now that's thought of as like really groovy and exotic when you see like that rainbow bag in the store with the purple and the white that looks like a parsnip and the yellow. Carrot eating has been on the rise for eons, but scientists say that the nutritional value of the vegetable has declined over time. This is another reason why when Big Zog keeps on telling everyone through the vegetableist or vegan agenda, oh, vegetables have so many nutrients, it's not even true anymore. Like at one point, they were like a good source of many things. Like in the 40s, like during the war, broccoli was still a good source of copper. And now there's like no copper in broccoli. So it's like, it's not just that we can't just eat the plant foods, but we also have to make sure we're eating the ones that are grown in a vitalized soil. So it's been declining over time, especially after World War II. There's a huge decline. I mean, a lot of stuff at that point, birth became more medicalized, circumcision basically took hold, you know, this thing with the soil, iron fortification. I mean, holy hell, when you look back and you see what they were doing, birth control pill about a decade or so later. So if you look back, yeah, it's been planned. In a landmark study published in 2005, University of Texas researchers professor analyzed a USDA carrot nutrient data collected between 1950 and 2000 and saw a decline in the amount of protein, calcium, phosphorus, iron, riboflavin, B2, and vitamin C in modern carrots bred over time for their size, growth, rates, yield, and pest resistance, not nutrient density. And that's what they breed everything for. Chicken, they want the chicken with the biggest breasts, right? It's not about nutrient density. It's about the yield. Like that article I read on that show, The Now Age, it's about getting the biggest fish. And if soy isoflavones have to be utilized, you get the biggest fish, even if it makes the people who eat it like sterile and it makes guys grow breasts, right? Whatever, the biggest fish, most amount of money, that's what matters. Regenerative agriculture practices like low and no tilling of the soil, using rotational cover crops to let fields rest every few years, and integrating grazing animals into the mix are being used more and more on smaller farms around the world. The result is nutrient-dense soil that can put carbon out of the air and help fight climate change, hold onto water better, and grow more nutrient-dense vegetables like carrots. This may just be the season to buy your carrots from a local small farmer who uses these practices. They may be better for both your body and the earth. And yeah, that definitely will be. And you can taste the difference. After having like a carrot that was grown in the right soil, like the right way, it made me realize the ones in the store taste like wood. And then it made me realize how old a lot of the onions in the store are. Garlic, like potatoes, sweet potatoes, like so many of these things are really old apples. Apples could be 2 years old by the time we buy them. Like it's mind-seeing. Squash, like all these things could be incredibly old and just like lazing around in the store for all we know. Thoughts of Seeds is saying, as a vegan, I used to juice the greens along with others to make, quote, burgers from the pulp. Oh, the carrot tops. Wow, that must have been really an intense juice. I never juiced them, but I went through like this juice phase in the early 2000s. I had like a centrifugal omega juicer, and I was juicing like so many different things. Like I juiced garlic one time. Oh my God, that was really just gross. I tasted it like all day. It kept on repeating on me. It was gross. What else? I did like scallion. That was gross too. Radish was gross. Broccoli was gross. And like a lot of this is really, it's not healthy. Despite not tasting very good, it's not healthy. This can be suppressive for many functions in the body. So it's not just healthy to run anything through a juicer. And if you are using just like regular veggies, then how much nutrients are like actually going to be in there, right? I mean, people are being duped buying this Ajunda, but of course they're playing at people's heartstrings, and they want people are going to think, oh, I could save animals, whatever. The Big Z will do whatever to get your vote, essentially, right? That's the way it works. So this magazine has actually a very nice recipe for carrots, grilled carrots. I'll share it here, and I'll post it in the Telegram group after I archive the show. So it's grilled carrots with za'atar. Za'atar is this Middle Eastern dip type of thing. It's like a dry thing that you sprinkle on food. I think it's got sumac, thyme, and something else. You can make it yourself, of course, or you could buy it. But it's got a very interesting taste. Za'atar. Okay. So it's sesame seeds, sumac, which is like a dried berry, which is like a souring agent, typically thyme, and sea salt. So it's a roasted carrot recipe using za'atar, labneh, which is like a soft yogurt cheese. You basically take yogurt and you strain it, I guess, like overnight or so, and you get this soft cheese. Typically, they serve it with olive oil. So here's a groovy recipe where it says the carrots are grilled. Labneh is really nice with the Middle Eastern za'atar. You can use different spices if you fancy. You could also do goat cheese with herbs de Provence or ricotta with chopped parsley and red chili flakes. So it's really just a recipe for grilled carrots. You could probably even do them roasted if you want to do them roasted. It's just basically roasted roots with a little bit of soft cheese and herbs of choice. This could probably also be done with like beets, rutabaga, turnips, sweet potatoes, regular potatoes, whatever you want to do to vary it and keep it sexy. This could actually be a very nice dish to go along with some nice stewed meat or some other meat you could serve alongside it. So basically you just toss the carrots with olive oil, salt, and pepper. You grill them, turning off in 7 to 10 minutes. On direct heat, then you take them away, put them on like non-direct heat, cover the grill 15 to 20 minutes, cook them. I would just probably roast them. I'd probably just cut them up with olive oil or not olive oil. I'd probably use refined coconut oil or ghee, and I would just roast them in the oven. And then you just serve them with a little bit of labneh smeared on the plate, drizzle with a little bit of olive oil, a little bit of lemon zest, and then add the za'atar, which is just the sesame seed, the sumac, and the thyme. So that sounds pretty groovy. Definitely a nice dish right there. And yeah, carrots are something that we should be eating, especially if it's a food that grows in your area. I mean, what's more racial than eating what grows in your area? Wouldn't we want to maximize that as opposed to not? I mean, we'd also be eating fresher, healthier, most likely more affordable. Yeah. Thoughts of Seeds is saying, yeah, it was all part of the raw superfood vegan cult. Very new agey and keen Richard, oh boy, that sounds repulsive. Yeah, I've tried a lot of these concoctions myself. I remember one time making these pistachio burgers, which like used heaps of pistachios. And then I had to dehydrate them. I think they were sun-dried tomato. They actually tasted pretty good, but they were so dense. Like we're really not designed to eat that many nuts. You know, maybe like a little bit here and there. Like sometimes I'll add a little bit of nuts to like a dessert or something like that. But I don't think we're meant to eat like a nut burger or a rice burger or any of this zogwash, a bean burger. Like those are not burgers. It's just, and we're not really meant to eat the food prepared that way. Anyway, another one of those snares. Sounds more like oy vey as opposed to new agey. Well, yeah, pretty much the same thing, just like a different way of saying it. Okay, so now moving on in the broadcast, I wanted to talk a little bit about rustic fruit desserts. Oftentimes the desserts that get most of the play are like cakes, cupcakes, a lot of these candy, chocolate, caramel type of desserts. What about fruit, right? What about fruit? Isn't that something that we should kind of reclaim these desserts, which happen to be European desserts, by the way? Let's say other cultures don't have fruit desserts. They, of course, do, but these are using the fruits of, well, basically a lot of these recipes that we're going to be talking about, or dishes rather, are of European heritage. And of course, you'll see these show up in America, Canada, you know, other parts of the world, South Africa and New Zealand, I don't know, Australia. You'll see these recipes crop up in any part of the world where there are whites, essentially. So I have this really groovy book that I actually just got the other day when I was at a thrift shop, actually, and I got this really fun book. It's called Rustic Fruit Desserts, Crumbles, Buckles, Cobblers, and Pandowdies. So maybe some of you don't even know. You're like, what is a pandowdy? What is a buckle? Like maybe you know what a cobbler or a crumble is, but some of these desserts unfortunately have gone by the wayside for a lot more of these zoggy books that aren't really, you know, peddling these zoggy recipes, rather, that really aren't as good as these old fashioned ones. So let's read a little bit about what are these desserts, these classic fruit desserts of our people, and then a little bit about some of the seasonal fruits this time of year. Of course, if you live in a temperate climate, I'm assuming not all of us do, but probably many of us listening to this do have like a four seasons style of climate. And even if you don't, it could be applicable for one or more of the seasons that you do experience. So here is a little bit about all these things. What's a pie? What's a galette? A tart? All of these things. Okay. One moment. Okay. So probably most people know what a pie is, I would presume. A pie is a dessert with a filling, in this case fruit, with a bottom crust and an optional top crust. Pies with both a bottom and top crust are often referred to as a double crust. Hand pies are a signature item at this restaurant, they're saying, featured in this book, Baker and Spice. I think it was in the Pacific Northwest somewhere. These individual pocket pies have a pie filling and a flaky crust that is folded over and crimped shut. That's kind of like those Drake's pies of yesteryear, or like the McDonald's apple pie. And of course, there are many, many savory connotations of pie as well, especially in European cookery. You see that in Australian cookery. You see it sometimes in America with things like the chicken pot pie, steak and kidney pie in the UK, fish pies there as well as in Australia. They have some meat pies there as well. So pie was something that many men could just take on the go in their luncheon satchel and have that little thing all crimped together without like a sandwich possibly, you know, falling away. So close relatives of the pie include the tart and the galette. A tart is a pie without a top crust. The fruit filling can be either fresh or cooked and is often coupled with another sweet, creamy filling. And a tart also is baked in a kind of a fluted shell that usually has a bottom that comes out, that's scalloped, actually not fluted, scalloped edge, as opposed to a pie plate where there's usually a lip and the crust, you know, falls over the lip, essentially. A galette is a rustic freeform tart that does not require a pan. So basically a galette is just the dough, the filling, and then it's like crimped and folded over, and then sometimes an egg wash is put on. A galette can be made not just with stuff like apples and plums and pears. It can also be made with like squash and red onions and goat cheese and chili flakes. So it can be taken in any direction, essentially. A cobbler, and this typically, when I think of a cobbler, I think of the American South, because that's typically where it's most common. A cobbler is a deep dish fruit pie. It has a dense pastry on top, usually a sweet cream biscuit crust, and a fruit filling, with no crust beneath. In some versions, the crust completely covers the fruit, whilst in other versions have a dropped biscuit topping that leaves some of the fruit exposed. And I actually made two of these recently. This week, I made a mixed berry one, just kind of using up all the berries of late summer or now, you know, early autumn, and it was blueberries, cherries, and black plums, and this one had like a cornmeal, slightly like a cornmeal crust, and the one I made a few weeks ago is just a classic peach cobbler. So the next dessert is a grunt or a slump. This is like a real blast from the past. It's more common in New England than in the Pacific Northwest, so this is regional. This dessert is similar to a cobbler, but it's cooked on the stove as opposed to the oven. So basically a grunt or a slump, it's that noise it makes. That's why they call it a grunt or a slump. It's a stovetop cobbler. In some parts of New England, it is a steamed pudding with berries. And all these things, steamed pudding and all this stuff, this is very popular. A lot of desserts were steamed back in the day. Now the idea of a steamed dessert sounds insane probably to most people, unless you're cooking like cheesecake in an electric pressure cooker or pressure cooker. A crisp or a crumble is a baked fruit dessert with a streusel topping. The crumb topping is traditionally made with butter, brown sugar, flour, and spices, and usually a little bit of salt as well. Nuts and oats, and even breadcrumbs and crushed cookies like shortbread cookies, ginger cookies, etc., can be added to the topping. The crumb topping is then scattered over the fruit and it usually melts onto it. So that's another way of doing it, crisp or crumble. And of course, stuff like a cobbler, a grunt, a slump, crisp, a crumble, these are easier to put together than a pie, a tart, or a galette, because all of those require that you roll the dough out, right? So oftentimes the other ones can be prepared very quickly, especially if you were using a fruit that didn't need to be peeled. Of course, apples and peaches and pears typically have to be peeled. You really can't peel berries, and typically plums are better with the skin on. Another dessert that you probably haven't heard of is called a Betty. It features fruit that is layered between one or on top of diced bread cubes. Anything from basic white bread to brioche to hallahoaks to day-old baguette. In some parts of the country, the Betty is made like a crisp, only with buttered breadcrumbs, no nuts or oats, as a streusel. Another uncommon dessert is a pan dowdy. A pan dowdy is a deep dish dessert that can be made with a variety of fruit. The topping is a crumbled biscuit, except the crust is broken up during the baking process and pushed down into the fruit to allow the juices to come through. Sometimes the crust is on the bottom and the dessert is inverted before serving. A buckle. A buckle is a cake batter poured into a single layer with berries added to the batter. It is often made with blueberries because berries sink yet keep their shape in the batter. Once baked, the cake has a, quote, buckled appearance. Think of a buckle as halfway between a cake and a fruit crisp. A tea cake. A tea cake is a simple cake akin to a coffee cake. Moist and tender, it can be eaten with one's fingers at tea time or any other time. Tea cake packs well for picnics. And now here are two desserts that really aren't in the same category because they're not really like flowery desserts. They're more like refrigerator desserts. And that would be a fool. This is an English dessert, I believe. It's a simple summer dessert made with fruit at its peak layered with fresh whipped cream. And I believe this one is also British. A trifle is a visually stunning dessert made by layering cake, thick cream, and fresh fruit. Some trifles will contain a small amount of alcohol, such as Cointreau, rum, or kirsch. So that's some interesting information about different desserts that our people have made throughout time. It would be nice to see some of these desserts making a comeback. And this book is so great because it's got lots of great pictures. Again, it's called Rustic Fruit Desserts by Corey Schreiber and Julie Richardson. They're both white as well. So this is... really good stuff, this book. I wanted to read a little bit more in regards to some of these seasonal fruits for this time of year. Let me just find that part of the book. Oh. It's separated into seasons too, which is super nice. So here is the fall season. So for things like fall, they have stuff like maple apple dumpling, grape galette, upside down pear chocolate cake. Interesting. So of course, there's many different types of apples to choose from. That's one of the highlights of this time of year. I mean, they name so many apples here that I haven't even heard of all these. Gravenstein, King of Tompkins County, Cox Orange Pippin, Jonathan, Golden Delicious, Suncrisp, Stamen Winesap, Jonah Gold, Belle de Buxkop, Macoun, Newton Pippin, Braeburn, Fuji, Pink Lady, Granny Smith, Pink Pearl. Pink Pearl are super cool. They're in season now. They are pink in the insides. They make this rosy pink applesauce. And of course, every apple has its own texture that makes it good. Like stuff like Granny Smith are good for pies because they have like a lot of like, they hold up really well. You know, they have a good firm texture. Oh, the Arkansas Black. That's my favorite apple. I only had it once. One of my favorite apples. That or the Blanc de Hiver. It almost has like a dark red or a black skin. I was once at this farm market in one of the most unsavory areas of San Francisco. This was a while ago, maybe like 7 years ago. I had a walk through this area where there were a lot of crack-addled Negroes. But I wanted to go to the farmer's market. So I went to this farmer's market and got this Arkansas black apple. And it was super delicious. But you had this amazing farm market with all these really tasty goods just in the middle of this really low vibrational, zoggy area where there was just a lot of drugs and crime and homelessness and just not a good scene at all. But that's oftentimes what cities are like. There'll be something kind of amazing somewhere, and then right next to it will be something that's completely contrary to that. But if you've ever had an Arkansas black apple, you know what I'm talking about. It's just a beautiful apple in general. And of course, if an apple has a very dark skin, it will affect the end product, especially if you do not take that skin off. Oftentimes in desserts, it's nice to peel the apple, unless of course it's grated, that'd be a different story. Something else in season is figs. Figs, black figs, brown figs, green figs. Oftentimes you really have to pick these out very carefully yourself because they bruise so easily. Figs should be plump and soft, but not mushy. Calamirna, Adriatic have the golden skin, brown turkey and celeste are brownish purple, Codota figs have an amber skin, and mission figs are a deep purple. They are highly perishable, absolutely, and oftentimes they're available dry, but they don't taste the same dry. Yeah, it's a really rustic book, Thoughts of Seeds, lots of dense, tasty recipes, and lighter stuff, of course, for the summer and the spring. I mean, there's rhubarb stuff in the spring, obviously, a lot of stone fruit and berries in the summer. Fall is all the stuff I'm mentioning now. Winter's like, you know, cranberries, apples, a little bit of citrus. It's great. I mean, living with the seasons is just one more thing you can do to connect, especially now where there's so many things that they want you to plug in, like literally plug into all these realities that essentially don't exist, when we need to plug back in or just pull the plug out on that zogginess and, you know, plug in or tune in, vibe in to our own thing, not theirs. So grapes, something else that's in season right now. So many different grapes, golden ones, light green, rosy pink, plum purple, blue black. Grapes should be plump and blemish free, not split open or brown when you're buying them. Huckleberries, depending on where you live in the world. Huckleberries are something else. They look a lot like blueberries, but they have tiny soft, they have 10 large seeds, whilst blueberries have tiny soft seeds. So something else like a berry, like a late summer, early fall berry. Pears, of course, which will continue to be in season as we go into the winter. Many different types of pears. There's Camas, which ripens later. Bartlett, which ripens in the early fall. There's Bosch, there's Anjou. Pears tend to have a grainy texture, I guess, if they're not used at the right time. Pears are ready when they have a gentle pressure. They give to a gentle pressure. It's probably sweet and juicy on the inside and ready to use for baking. Pear sauce is a good way to use overripe pears. If you just have pears that are just completely just gone, a pear sauce, of course, could be paired with either sweet or savory food. Oftentimes, if you look back at a lot of the earlier cookery in Europe, before we had the potato, the tomato, you know, all the nightshades and things like that, because we didn't originally have those things there, especially potatoes as a starch, which have now become a staple starch in many European countries. They are here in the States, other parts of the white world. They're popular in Australia. So, what was I going to say? Yeah, pears. Pears can be, fiddlesticks. I just lost what I was talking about. But yeah, pears are something that can be used for, if the sauce is, if the pears are too ripe, you can just make a sauce with it. Oh yeah, I was saying that before we had all these vegetables, like these vegetables of the new world, we were pairing our meats with roots, things like roots, like carrots, rutabaga, beets, squash, turnips. Turnips used to be much, much more popular here and across the pond. Many years ago, that was like one of the main staples of the farming diet here in America was turnips, and that's kind of completely gone by the wayside. So before we had all these crops of the new world, you know, quote, the new world, we were eating like these pear sauces or, you know, stewed apples or something like that along with the meat. And I've talked before in the context of things like turkey cranberry sauce, lamb mint jelly, chicken with like an orange sauce. We've always kind of had something like that in times past when you think about it, when we were just looking to get some type of carbohydrate in the diet. And of course, much more digestible than a lot of these grains and stuff like that, especially if they're not properly prepared. And there's really never been any literature given out from Big Zog or even like Zog Light about the, you know, importance of how grains and beans and stuff like that are actually prepared. Of course, they want you to eat food that just like fills you up, like literally fills you up. And then they just want you to basically be malnourished, even though you're, quote, full. So that's how, like, even if you're full, it doesn't mean that you're actually, you know, satiated, you're just full. Thoughts of Seeds is saying Saskatoon berries, Amelanchier alnifolia, look much like blueberries, though they are more closely related to the apple family, popular in Canada. You know, I think I've heard of these berries. I'm not sure I've actually ever seen a picture. So yeah, all different parts of the white world will have berries. Like think of all the berries that they have like in areas like Scandinavia, right? I mean, there's so many different berries, lingonberries, I think of those, right? I think trolls are known for eating lingonberries, actually. I mean, there's so many berries. We only think of like what, the berry trio, strawberry, blueberry, maybe blackberry, raspberry, that's typically what we think of, blackberry. You know, we don't really think of these berries. So another fruit, one that always has to be cooked, oftentimes paired with cheese, it's much more popular across the pond. It's super sour and astringent if you eat it raw, is quince. Quince. It looks like an apple, but it's kind of like a little different looking. It's typically firm and yellow. They can bruise easily, and you want to store it in a plastic bag in the fridge for several days and peel it before you use it. Oftentimes, it's cooked down with a fair amount of sweetener, just like a crab apple would be based on its tartness. So another fruit this time of year is fall raspberries. All berries are fragile and deteriorate quickly after being picked, especially fall raspberries. Check carefully under the top layer of berries in the basket to ensure that your berries underneath are not crushed or moldy. They should be plump and shiny, and of course, this could be a nice thing to use in conjunction with an apple, right? Or apple blackberry pie. That's one of the desserts in here. Gingered pear and raspberry pandowdy. There's an idea of using pear with raspberry, and this also calls for using a little bit of candied ginger. A grape galette, that sounds pretty sexy. Using, doesn't really say what type of grapes. Any type of grapes, I guess, would be applicable. Oh, and also I should mention pear goes very nicely with the scent or the flavor of vanilla. That's a nice pairing because pears have naturally kind of like a vanilla undertone. So a little bit about rustic fruit desserts. Hopefully you learned something there. Now you know what a pandowdy, a buckle, grand slump, all of this stuff is. And of course, there's recipes in other books besides this one. But like, I was able to like get this book for like $2 or something like that. I think it was $2. It's hardcover. It came out in, I think, 06. It originally, 09. It originally retailed for $22. But yeah, it's a good book. And you feel like in a better mood when you like read about this than when you see like, what's Zog up to today? What are they doing today? You know, that type of stuff. I mean, gosh, that can get pretty tiresome, can't it? So what else do I have for today's broadcast? Okay. Oh yeah, something I was talking about a little bit earlier about cooking and just connecting to our roots, like via food and all that stuff. This is a great way for us to connect with each other too, is what we're eating. You know, what if we're all eating the same meal? What if we're all doing the same meditation? Wouldn't that be a good way to create some type of energy, right? Especially when there's so many things that are just trying to steal that energy and kind of push it in the other way. And recently, one of the listeners knows that I'm a fan of cookbooks, especially vintage cookbooks. So she was in a position where she was somewhere where she had access to some books at a book sale, and she sent me a bunch of vintage cookbooks. It was so awesome, so wonderful. Thank you, listener, for doing that. And one of the cookbooks that she sent me was this one that's so old, it doesn't even have a year in here when it was written. It looks like maybe it could have been missing a first page. No, I think the binding is just rather elderly. But I'm thinking this is from the 40s. It's this pretty old book right here. I can tell by some of the recipes. It's a cookbook of yore. And it's called The Way to a Man's Heart, The Settlement Cookbook. And it's this wonderful appendix. Actually, now it looks like some of the first pages are ripped out. It looks like it just starts with O, like when it's going through the recipes, it starts with oranges. So let me see if I can just look online. I wonder how old this is. But these oftentimes are the best cookbooks because you will find, obviously, European or white recipes. Not to say that recipes from other parts of the world aren't good. They are. I'm a fan of all types of food. I am a true multiculturalist. I can cook anything from Mexican to Burmese food and do it well. And well, I just pretty much taught myself how to do it. Wow, this book is from 1936. Damn, this is one of my oldest cookbooks. And that's really awesome. I think I have one more that's actually 1934. But yeah, this is, what a gift, what a jewel to have this book. And it has a smell to it. You can tell the person that owned it probably smoked for like years. So it's got like that baked smell of like, you know, the time that someone this book probably hung in the kitchen. Maybe they were smoking and cooking when they were using this book, but it tells you everything, like basic things that people don't even know anymore, like what baking means, what scoring, sauteing, roasting, and masking means, different weights and measures, a very impressive and complete book, and some awesome recipes too. You see recipes for all different types of things: tripe, calf's heart, calf's brains, kidney, oxtail, liver sausage, all these things that people probably wouldn't be eating in abundance nowadays because they've been propagandized to believe that vegetation is sustenance. They've been also propagandized via the Hollyweird movies, especially the slasher films. A lot of those films probably coming out like in the 70s, those horrific B movies where like the blood literally looked like ketchup. Yeah, it's been going on, this pogrom, on a multifaceted level, like on the transhumanist shows I did with Jason last week. You can check those out, please do. Great shows. Yeah, people are just falling for everything, and there's so many different like heads of the Hydra or tentacles of the octopus just there, you know, so it permeates through. But wow, this is a great book, and that's my thought on just this in general, but also just how we can connect via food, maybe all making the same recipe, like I said earlier, or just how we each can connect, like what European subrace are you? Why don't you connect with one of those dishes that you are? Like for me, I could connect with something that was Hungarian, Sicilian, Irish, you know, English, connect with that type of food. This is a great way to kind of become more rooted in our racialism, especially as there's pogroms to pogroms that are trying to deracinate us 24/7. This book also has a category, I love it, called Jellied Salads. Everything from how to just make an aspic jelly, which of course, usually you pour over something like a pâté, which is super cool. I think I'm gonna be making like duck pâté probably tomorrow or the next day. All great, great stuff. Just a great cookbook altogether. But that's how we can really connect, or one of the ways I think we can connect is rooting into that. So it's for me, just in general, even though I don't necessarily eat a ton of, you know, Irish, English, Sicilian, or Hungarian food, I eat a lot of foods that are present in those areas. Like, for example, Sicily is an island. You know, the areas in the British Isles, like Ireland, that's an island. So, and I live on an island, so I like fish. That works for me, right? So you kind of find out what works. Maybe you have it, you're from an area where like there was a lot of like goat and sheeps, and maybe you live near that. Maybe you need to have like that type of meat. You find what works for you. But that's a great way to kind of root in more. I think as time goes on, as the pogroms keep on going on and on and on and on and on, I think rooting in is going to be more important than ever before. One of the ways we can do that is via food. And of course, there's a ritual. Again, back to ritual. We talked about Mabon in the beginning of the broadcast. Back to ritual. There's so much importance of having these rituals. I mean, they want us to do rituals like stand 6 feet apart, wear this chat feed bag. You know, like we need our own rituals, and obviously not to be doing their rituals. This book is really groovy. I'm just checking out all the recipes for things that I haven't even heard about. I mean, how great is that? You know, learning about all this this extra stuff, all these old desserts like frozen Nesselrode, which is this frozen dessert with candied fruit and chestnuts, angel parfait, which is a parfait with walnuts and pineapple and things like that. It's just an interesting book. Ooh, goose liver appetizer. Oh, wow, that sounds so good. I think that's probably foie gras what they mean. Oh, no, it's a slice of, oh, it is, it's foie gras. Goose liver, that is the food that is the highest in vitamin K2, one of the fat-soluble vitamins. Of course, K1 is in vegetation, green vegetation like kale and dandelion, nettles. Of course, if you didn't want the fiber of the vegetation, but you still wanted the minerals of the vegetation, you could take stuff like a nettles tea or a dandelion tea without getting the fiber. Maybe if you couldn't digest that, you can just get the minerals of the vegetation. Of course, you could always boil vegetation like kale and then just drink that that broth. So yeah, goose liver, highest source of vitamin K2. I think it's across the board. I've been trying to get my hands on some goose liver now for a couple of months with no avail. And the highest source of vitamin A, I think, in any food. I learned this the other day. It's not beef liver. It's turkey liver, actually. I mean, beef liver has other stuff that poultry liver does not have, but the poultry liver is much higher in K2. You typically eat the beef liver for like the B12, the folate, the copper. Some people do it for the iron, stuff like that. But yeah, the highest source of vitamin A actually comes from turkey liver. I'm trying to get my hands on that too, but not available right now. I never would have thought about eating other parts of the turkey. I always thought of like chicken as the go-to, you know, for other parts. But yeah, I guess other birds' parts can be really good too. Also, gizzards is something else that you can eat. It's that that thing that helps the birds, like, you know, digest all this crazy crap, like, you know, shells and fragments of stuff. But you can eat the gizzard too. That's got a lot of minerals in it. Just has to be cooked really well. I mean, these are all the things that we used to eat many years ago, but just not anymore. All gone by the wayside. So many things that were helpful to our health have gone by the wayside. So hopefully the purpose of these shows, especially a show like this, is to reconnect us to that in some way, to have some semblance of that, especially as they try more and more to get us to believe these things, to pull ourselves out of our roots. I mean, anyone who's deracinated is essentially rootless. Don't the UIVs typically refer to themselves as the rootless cosmopolitan? So like they value being rootless, or they value having their own roots kind of like shrouded and then making everybody else rootless and then promoting that they're rootless and then they can just go anywhere, do anything, etc. Not a good vibe at all. So that's all I wanted to say on the settlement cookbook and just connecting via recipes, rooting into your race, connecting with the foods of your race, cooking, actually learning how to cook. There's a lot of great resources out there. Oftentimes I find the older books have some of the best recipes. Just oftentimes in the older books, they expect that everyone knew how to cook. Like in this book I'm reading right here, the actual ingredients are like, you know, normal length, but the directions for the recipe is really just a small little blurb. And there's like, sometimes like five or six recipes on one page, because they assume in 1936 that if you bought this book, you already knew what it looked like to grade something. You knew what a grater is. You knew how to extract the juice out of an orange. You knew to use a whisk to mix it together in a glass bowl. Like, these are things that were taken for granted. Just like I think now Home Depot has to have like a directions on the hammer. So if you're not knowing all these basic things, because unfortunately we weren't taught these things, it's not necessarily your fault. It's the society's fault, parents buying into the society, whatever it may be, the pogroms putting two parents in the workforce. There are many different reasons why, but even though these older cookbooks are the best resources for finding like the best recipes and just kind of really connecting to the food of us, you'll probably want to find directions in some instances somewhere else just by looking around in case you're not sure on all of those things. I mean, a lot of us weren't taught all this stuff. Back in the day, like it was known that at least, you know, one person in the relationship, typically the woman, knew how to cook. But now that's not the way it really works these days. Not in a lot of the people that I talk to or I hear stuff from. I'm oftentimes aghast when I hear these things. I guess I just have a different value. But yeah, everyone needs to know how to cook, male, female, old, young. It's a good skill for all of us to have. And isn't it weird how typically in the household it was always ladies that were cooking? And then when you think about it in a professional sense, most professional chefs are men. It's just kind of weird. Okay, I think we will take a musical break so I can have a beverage, and we will be right back. Let me just get some more seasonal music. I've got another 60s song. This one is from 1965. Okay, be back in just a few. Let me just get that speaker where it needs to be so we can hear it. All right. Thank you.
to everything. Turn, there is a season. Turn, and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to gain, a time to lose, a time to rend, a time to sow, a time for love, a time for hate, a time for peace. I swear it's not too late.
All right, we are back. White Wellness Radio, Autumnal Abundance. That was The Byrds with Turn, Turn, Turn. To everything there is a season. Back in 1965. I thought that was appropriate because we are turning the season right now, right? Which is pretty magical, pretty groovy. So we've talked a lot about food, the equinox, the Norse goddess of bloodlines, Hydla. So there's a lot that we've talked about thus far, trying to paint the picture for the season, trying to give that autumnal abundance essence through the broadcast. So now I want to talk a little bit about self-care, moving from the fruits of the season, the goddess of the season, the season, moving now into a little bit of self-care, and self-care that reflects the time of year that we're in right now. So let me just get to that note right here. Okay, so autumn self-care. So here are some ideas, and these are all kind of like cozy things. It's what the, is it the Danes? I'm trying to think what area of the world. The people who have the, I think it is them. Let's see. Yes, it is the Danes and the Norwegians. Okay, hygge, which is spelled very differently.
Hygge.
H-Y-G-G-E, but it's said hygge. I've talked about this before on the broadcast, but it kind of pertains to what I'm saying here. It's a Danish and Norwegian word for a mood of coziness and comfortable conviviality with feelings of wellness and contentment. As a cultural category with its sets of associated practices, hygge has more of or less the same meaning in Danish and Norwegian, but the notion is more central in Denmark than in Norway. So what are some examples of this? Having candles, tea, maybe a nice pair of socks, maybe having some plants in the house. And this is also very much what you would do like in the autumn, this time of year. Spend time with people who you love. Try out new hobbies. So of course, cooking is like a pretty awesome hobby. You can be enjoying the fruits of the season. Baking with apples. We already talked a lot about rustic desserts. Baking with other fall fruits as well. Drinking spiced cider. That could be really awesome. No, this show isn't over. No, not yet. Okay. Drinking spiced cider. You can just like, you know, buy some cider and add like a cinnamon stick, star anise, you know, cloves, groovy stuff like that. You can make golden milk where you take milk and then you mix that with like turmeric and black pepper, a little bit of ginger. Or I find actually buying a turmeric ghee and then just adding that to the milk, because then the turmeric ghee actually has the ginger and the black pepper already in it. Enjoying warm socks and PJs, or what I like to call my pajama costume. Slow down and savor the moment. Of course, this is all like more on the intuitive vein too, as opposed to being, you know, so logical, so analytical, you know, all the time. Just kind of need more balance as a society, if not as humans. Enjoying a cup of tea, perhaps a herbal cup of tea, making soup or stew. I've been loving borscht a lot as of late. That's a soup that floats all around Eastern Europe. It's typically made with beef. I don't really like that. So I just do mine with vegetation. I'll do like a beet, a borscht, with carrots and onions. I will typically leave out any of the vegetables that I don't like or the ones that I don't think digest very well. And I like to have that with like a plop of sour cream. I'll add caraway seeds to it, which of course is in the parsley family. And oftentimes I will make it with like a turkey stock, like a nice wiggly jiggly turkey stock that I made from turkey feet and turkey heads. Writing down what you want to let go of, that's a good autumnal self-care recipe or self-care habit. Oftentimes people do this practice where they write down like all the stuff they think that sucks, that like, you know, people who fuck them over, like whatever, and then they just like burn that piece of paper, you know, and they try to process it and let it go by just writing out like, and you might even write out stuff that you'd probably never tell the other person, maybe never tell anybody else, but you get that energy out. Going on a nature walk, what a great thing. That's a great thing right there. Going to the farm market, decorating pumpkins, making pumpkin bread. I saw a great recipe for pumpkin muffins the other day with pecans. See, that's where I would use a couple of nuts, would be if I was making like muffins or something and I wanted to add like some pecans or some walnuts or some sass like that, as opposed to just, you know, just vegetarting out on like a pistachio burger or something like that. So those are just some basic ideas of autumnal self-care. Reading a book. You could have the cozy socks and the pajama costume on whilst you're reading a book and having some spiced cider, maybe with some relaxing tunes on in the back. So just creating this like cozy cave. We all have the right to do that. Even if the world is like fucked up and kind of in shambles, we all have the right to still create that little like kind of boundary. And that kind of like not just resonates as a way to, you know, become more inward, especially as the season is getting in more that direction, and, you know, care about yourself, protect your aura, strengthen it, etc. It also kind of, to the system, it gives this attitude of this anagram that was popular about, I don't know, the 2007 era. Maybe some of you cats remember it. It was called Diligoff. Do I look like I give a fuck? And if you're all involved in your own thing, strengthening your own self, strengthening the people you know IRL as well as online, you're strengthening, you know, your unit, whatever it may be, then you diligoff to what's going on with Zog and, you know, the other races, like whatever, like you're aware of it, you prepare for it, you counter it, but you don't give a fuck. And I think that's kind of like a good attitude to have, because if we truly just harp on giving a fuck of all of this thing, when are we going to have the time for self-care? When are we going to give a fuck about ourselves if we give a fuck about them, right? I'd rather give a fuck about myself and us than them. Just like I care about us, I don't care about them. I want to talk about us, not them. I'll mention all the shit they're doing, call them out for it, but I want to talk about us, not them. Okay, so what else do I have for this broadcast? Let's see right here. Oh, this will be good information. This will kind of bring us more into the intuitive notion of the broadcast. Wait, maybe I had one more thing I wanted to mention with the autumnal self-care. One moment. Rewind just a second. Let's see what we have right here. Oh, yeah, a couple of other things. I'll mention this now, and then we'll talk about the spleen and kind of talk about food and nutrition and making harmony in the body from more of an intuitive mentality, as opposed to more of this, you know, diagnostic kind of like, you know, just more yang way. We're going to talk about the yin intuitive modality of healing, and we're going to talk about the spleen. But in addition to the autumnal self-care, there are also ways that you might want to ground yourself this time of year, and especially as we go into this colder time of year. The season's changing, the leaves changing, soon there'll be snow. That sounds pretty exciting to me. I mean, not so soon, but still. So what are ways that we can do some grounding? Remember, all this shit's free. Like, we don't have to spend heaps of cheese or heaps of money. Like, I mean, of course, you want to spend money on, like, food and, like, stuff like that, but this stuff is free, so it behooves us to try it. Sitting outside or facing a window and getting comfortable. Close your eyes, focus on breathing until you feel calm. Open your eyes and notice 5 things you can see. Notice 4 things you can hear, 3 you can feel, 2 you can smell, and 1 you can taste. So that's a way to really ground yourself into your environment. There are so many things, including technology, which I'm utilizing right now for the broadcast, that bring us out of that moment, utilizing your entire sensorium, possibly even 6th sense, you know, extrasensory perception. I think when all your senses are really lit up, then you can kind of work on that ESP, which is the intuitive, right? Groovy stuff right there. But there are many ways that we can kind of get back into ourselves. Big Z doesn't want us to be in that state, because when we're in that grounded kind of centered state, we're not going to nearly be as affected by all their crud, because we're going to have some semblance of balance, essentially. So now on to the spleen, an organ that doesn't get a lot of attention, especially in the allopathic Western medical system, also in the Zog Light functional medicine, also even in some of the more alternative or radical medical modalities. Everyone's talking about, you know, the blood and the heart and the digestive tract, the liver, and that's all jazzy. But what about the spleen, right? And the spleen actually has a certain time of day, according to TCM, traditional Chinese medicine, which is interesting. I did an entire broadcast last May titled The Human Body Energy Clock, I think, where I spent the whole time talking about this. So if you want to know more about that, check out that broadcast. It is archived over in the archive. But anyway, there's a time of day for every organ. This is pretty groovy. So the spleen, 9 a.m. to 10 to 11 a.m., like the organs go in like two-hour pieces, essentially, for the most part. Yeah, they're all 2 hours. So 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. is the spleen. This is a time you want to work and you want to be active. The spleen is associated with mental powers, supports the metabolism, and is responsible for converting nutrients into energy. So if someone's spleen was sluggish, if someone had a condition that had to do with a sluggish spleen, maybe they wouldn't be able to convert the nutrients into energy. They could have an energy problem, which I guess would be a metabolism problem, and also could manifest possibly mentally. There are three types of spleen conditions. There's what's called upper jiao, which is chest and lungs. There's middle jiao, which is abdomen, and lower jiao, which is pelvic region. So it manifests in different areas depending on the person. Everyone has a reason why they manifest something, where they do. It's a multitude of facets. Spleen issues, according to traditional Chinese medicine, are conditions of dampness. And that may be like, well, what the hell is dampness, right? When they say stuff like that, it's oftentimes to a Western mind, it's difficult to discern what they mean. So dampness, according to TCM, is happening mainly in, quote, developed countries, and it's due to a hormonal imbalance of estrogen. Of course, we've talked a lot in the broadcast about xenoestrogens, phytoestrogens, estrogen in general. I did a show a while back called Estrodysgenics. Estrogen is a stress or shock hormone. Of course, both men and women need a little bit in context. Women more to have a period, to get pregnant, all those types of things, but too much of it can cause havoc. So dampness is a condition of developed countries, mainly due to estrogen and secondarily due to consumption of refined food products and the processes that manufacture these foods. Also, it's dampness heat that is the prevalent condition. So how can heat be damp? Sounds kind of weird, right? So it's a form of inflammation, right? So the dampness is the stagnation, essentially, right? So it's damp, it's not moving, there's not enough flow. And then the heat is the inflammation. So that's damp heat. I hope that makes sense. Thus, fluid retention is also a characteristic of dampness. First, the condition will be described, and then the foods and herbs that are known to alleviate or exacerbate conditions will be presented. So that's why sometimes it's really hard just to give an overview of like what we should be eating, because it's really, I think it's pretty individual. Of course, there are different ways for it to present for everybody. Like a certain food may be a total no for someone and a yes for someone else. But the basic thing of making sure we're getting the right nutrients, that's kind of more of the basic thing. But then again, some people aren't going to do good. Like some people just, they can't eat chicken eggs, right? Some people just think fish is disgusting. Some people find red meat too heavy, right? So it really has to be developed strategically for that person. But typically I would always say everyone needs to be eating all three macronutrients and making sure you're getting enough of the vitamins and minerals. That has to be what you want to do for eating, but it's going to be different for everybody based on, you know, who they are.
Because, of course, we all have past things that are the reason why we're in the current stead that we're in. So what are some of the conditions associated with dampness or damp heat? One would be obesity. That's a pretty intense form of chronic inflammation. It's saying here that for obesity, they should always avoid all the soy products. Soybean oil is lurking in so many foods. Even if you don't like outright eat tofu or stuff like that or edamame, you can still get it if you're eating soy-fed meat. These foods have phytoestrogens in them, of course. Birth control pills. Actually, there's no soy in it, but there's estrogen, so it's kind of the same thing. Baby formula. There are so many, many ways. Also, high fructose corn syrup is another reason why obese people will get this damp condition. That is in a lot of food, even supposed like natural foods. And also, a lot of obese people are eating polyunsaturated, unnatural lipids, another reason for obesity, and those things could cause damp heat. I mean, I think probably most people listening avoid soy, avoid high fructose corn syrup, and avoid polyunsaturated fats. Those are basic. If you want to get yourself healthy, those are like three simple basic things. Avoid soy, especially the unfermented. If you have a little bit of like fermented, naturally fermented soy sauce or miso here and there, I don't think it's going to make or break, at least not everybody. If someone was seriously sick, maybe a bit different. Obviously, avoid all of the high fructose corn syrup and the polyunsaturates. So that would be the obesity, the manifesting of the obesity, the damp heat in obesity. Now there's one that's in the chest and lungs. This would be like a phlegmy condition. This would also be associated with the lungs and the large intestine. It will impair your digestion. It will cause chronic improper nutrition. Dampness will move to the lungs and you'll get phlegm while coughing. This will occur especially after the person consumes something that is inherently difficult to digest, particularly cold dairy or greasy foods. Dairy should be eaten at a room temp or warm. Oftentimes we don't do that here in the States. Ayurveda talks about doing that a lot. TCM in general is not a big fan of dairy, with the exception of yogurt. It says here that dairy can cause the dampness in TCM. Of course, it depends on what type it is. I wouldn't be eating the pasteurized, and I wouldn't really be eating stuff that wasn't really A2 or goat for the most part, because I think the other stuff is like really pretty deracinated. So I think in general that the lower quality quarterized pasteurized dairy could definitely cause dampness, even if some other dietary schools of thought will say dairy's good, it has progesterone and stuff like that. Yeah, but it can still cause dampness. So we have to like figure out, we have to intuit, like just because a food has good macronutrients, good vitamins and minerals, you know, helps with certain hormonal boosts, we have to find out, does this food particularly work for us right now? So the second, the third type in here is the abdominal dampness. And this is due to the high fatty content in the person's pancreas where the damp heat sets in. This typically revolves around what allopathy would say is type 2 diabetes. They would say in TCM, it's middle jowl and it's damp heat in the abdomen. The best way is to decrease pancreatic fat. They're saying is severe caloric restriction. Just like with obesity, type 2 diabetes and obesity go hand in hand. You know, I don't even know if calorie restriction would work to an extent, but I think it's not just, in the case of a lot of obese people, it's not that they eat a ton of calories, it's that they eat the wrong type of calories and the wrong food at the wrong time. I know some of them are like massive gorgers, but I think it's more than just that. I think it's the fact that the foods they eat are so metabolically suppressing, and maybe they would need to eat food on a more frequent schedule just to kind of get some semblance of balance. The fourth condition is called lower jowl. That's the pelvic region. So the abdomen and then the pelvic below it. So this would be things like polycystic ovarian syndrome, which seems to be on the rise, especially here in America. Endometriosis, fibroids in the uterus are examples of damp heat. These conditions are mostly due to an excessive burden of estrogen, Thus, restriction of estrogenic foods needs to be the first thing one should do in order to alleviate these conditions, as well as body weight reduction. The liver and the gallbladder are also affected by the excess consumption of fatty foods. Jaundice is a dampness condition of the liver. Gallstones are a dampness condition of the gallbladder. Fatty liver and gallstones seem to go together, but not all gallstones are composed mostly of cholesterol and the rest of bilirubin. And the fifth condition is any skin condition. I read the health, quote, health, you know, H-E-L-L-T-H magazines. They're loaded with adverts for allopathic drugs. And one I keep on seeing over and over and over and over again, psoriasis. So this must be on the rise. And psoriasis, according to TCM, would be damp heat. And see, all of these things I'm talking about right here, we're seeing a lot more of a lot of dampness in this society, a lot of spleen issues, obesity is on the rise, type 2 diabetes, pelvic region problems, people having respiratory problems, especially with, Wi-Fi sickness, annoyed AI, skin conditions, rashes, blotches, skin tags, things like that are all damp heat of the skin. Oftentimes it's a blood sugar correlation with this skin stuff as well. So the skin stuff is a result of an acute response to ingested foodstuffs in the case of skin tags and cholesterol deposits, and the chronic response to damp heat in the skin. The skin is the largest organ in the body. What the body is not able to eliminate in the fecal waste is absorbed and metabolized by the liver. So what if someone's liver is like in bad stead, right? A lot of people's livers, a lot of people have liver damage in this country. Millennials can have liver damage. Mine's Ying. Whenever the liver metabolizes, ends up in the blood or the bile, but may also be stored in the liver. The blood moves all the metabolites into the rest of the bodily fluids. Some metabolites end up in the adipose tissue, the fat cells, but some of the compounds in the blood seem to migrate from the blood into the interstitial fluid of the skin and cause acute dampness, heat signs, and symptoms. These compounds are mostly allergens and involve the immune system. Skin tags seem to be more related to toxic dampness, heat. Keratosis, as chronic damp heat in the skin, seems to be related to a chronic high body burden of estrogens, just like skin tags are. So a little bit about that. Of course, if you go to Big Z, they just want to give you some cream, some pill, some injection, something, as opposed to getting to the root cause of why the dampness might be occurring. Also, just excess body heat, like night sweats or just over sweating, that too is damp heat. So what are some foods and herbs for the therapy of damp heat, or foods that we should avoid according to TCM? It says milk products, especially yogurt. And like I said prior, I would have them raw and I wouldn't have them cold. I'd have them at like a room temp. I think that's probably, and of course, not going too hardcore on the ferments. Excess fermented foods is not good for damp heat. That's also too much lactic acid. So yeah, going easy on the milk products or just getting the right ones in the diet and not eating too many of them. Sugar and sweets. White wheat flour, refined starch and highly processed starch products, excessive raw fruit and vegetables, excessive mushrooms and fungi, any of the pepper family vegetables, icy and cold beverages, very popular here in America. We did not have the availability to have cold beverages until really recently in history. The fridge or the icebox was considered a sign of like status back in the day. So we're really not designed to be drinking beverages like that. It immobilizes the immune cells in the wall of the digestive tract. It can cause weight gain. It chills your digestive tract, so it makes it like a lot harder. It immobilizes like digestion in general, especially if you drink those cold beverages with a meal. You really should not be drinking with a meal. Like other, you know, more allopathic, like even the ones that think that they're, you know, not mainstream. They are mainstream. They just don't know it. And they think that whatever, they're still not talking about this more intuitive style of ferreting out what foods work for everybody, right? Excess of fermented foods. We said that yeast containing foods, excess vinegar, So those are the foods. You can even go online and look for more. Also, oranges and orange juice, even though some schools of thought will say that that's good for many things. Well, if someone has damp heat, not the best food for them. So we always have to figure out what foods work for us, different times of our lives. Sometimes we can get into a food too much and just kind of like abuse it or use it too much on repeat. So basically, the things that aren't good for damp heat are essentially too many foods that are just like yin in the wrong way, like too much raw vegetation or fruits, especially, you know, peppers, mushrooms being mycelium, not fruit or vegetable, anything that's really like refined. And yeah, just like us in certain fruits too, that's pretty much what it is. And then fermented stuff like vinegar, yeast, fermented foods. So what are some spices, and other foods that are known to cause, damp heat? Alcohol in many of its forms, deep fried foods, things like that, fatty and greasy. Of course, we do need a certain amount of fat in our diet, but it's different eating like a lamb chop and getting the little bit of fat on the lamb chop as opposed to even eating something like some fish fried in coconut oil, even though you can make that at home and that would be tasty. It's still better just not to have these deep fried foods. It's better having the food in the more intact way. So what are some spices that you can utilize to relieve the dampness? Garlic and onion, warm things like cinnamon, ginger, scallion, basil, rosemary, dill, oregano, sage, parsley, cardamom, nutmeg, fennel, anise, clove, coriander, leek, and chives. Also eating a food that's called Job's Tears, also known as Hatomugi. It's a pearl barley. That's the Japanese name, Hatomugi. The Chinese name is Yi Yi Ren. That's a good food for a dampness. It's actually very tasty too. And barley, even though it has gluten in it, it could be a good grain if you can soak it and prepare it the right way. Of course, you don't have to make them a staple of your diet, but it's a nice light yin food. Adduki beans can be something that is nice as well. These beans are really good for the kidneys. Qi jiang dou in Chinese. I grew up eating these beans. I don't do a lot of beans these days, but sometimes here and there I'll have them. Of course, I prepare them the right way. Other foods that are good for damp heat would be rye. That's another grain of Europe, just like barley. Both have gluten. Of course, neither of them were nearly ever as hybridized as wheat and other forms of that plant. So these can typically be had in more of a rustic way. You can even get bread that's like 100% rye. Celery, lettuce, and alfalfa are also good for the damp heat, as well as turnips, raw honey, and corn. And a good way to use any of these like herbs and spices I mentioned are like stir fry, soup, stew. Simple way to make like a one dish meal. Turmeric can also help with damp heat. I would not suggest taking turmeric like in a supplement form. I think that's just too intense way to use it. That's just not so great. I would just grate like a little bit into a stir fry, use a little bit of turmeric ghee in like a beverage or something like that. And of course it has to be paired with black pepper. So that's another way you could use it. But yeah, I would not recommend like taking like supplement type of stuff. It's just about adding this to your food as opposed to going crazy and someone pounding like 6 turmeric pills a day. Like that's just ridiculous, you know? Some of these herbs I mentioned can even be made into like a 5 spice tea, kind of like a pumpkin spice style tea, where you would mix like cinnamon, clove, ginger, allspice, and nutmeg, and then brew that. You can even add that to like a coffee or a tea if you utilized that. So a lot of things you can do with that. So yeah, interesting information right here, perhaps new to you, perhaps a different way of thinking about health, maybe make you think of ways that you might want to tweak what you're doing right now and maybe make some more adjustments. Another thing when I think about the spleen is like soups and stews, you know, herbal teas, like warmer style food as opposed to like all these kind of more Western foods, if you will, that are like cold, like grab and go. Like I think oftentimes it just doesn't serve us. And we may think that these foods on paper are good, but maybe we have to think a little bit further about that and say, oh, you know, it's not really working for me or my condition right here. There's more to discover or discern as opposed to like, oh, it just has, you know, these minerals and these macronutrients. Like, well, that's true, sure, but maybe it's just not for you. And when you're working this with yourself, it could be changing. I assess this once a month for myself. I make myself like this sheet, and I assess the things in bold that I want to work on and things to minimize. But often, again, going back to earlier in the show, think about your ancestral racial roots. Maybe you're eating a food that isn't congruent to your roots. Maybe it's just something you're that's available, right? But it's really not for you. So always think of that when you're like building like a kind of a meal plan. I think it's important. And again, another way that we can get back to our roots, especially in this this time where they just want to pull us away from everything that's good and Aryan. So I think I'll leave it at that for this week's broadcast, Autumnal Abundance. I thank everyone for listening. I hope everyone has an amazing autumnal equinox. I'm making chicken and potato, or chicken potato tonight, which is this groovy recipe where it's got a bunch of sliced potatoes and onions. I have an 8-way cut up chicken, so I'll have like 2 breasts, 2 wings, 2 drums, and 2 thighs. I'm going to put that with some groovy seasoning on top of the potatoes, cook that whole thing, and then serve it with probably some cooked vegetation on the side. So yeah, that's my plan for today. Wishing everyone well, having a wonderful, whimsical Wednesday. We will be connecting again soon on the next broadcast. Sat Nam, everybody.